It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. State lawmakers recently held a public hearing on a bill for a roughly $70 million tax incentives package for papermaker Kimberly-Clark Corporation to preserve jobs. Meanwhile, Governor-elect Evers is proceeding with transition plans, and Governor Scott Walker has spoken out about the election laws. We check in with WPR News State Capitol reporter Laurel White for the latest on the Wisconsin legislature. What are you watching when it comes to the Kimberly-Clark incentives? Do you want this measure to go through, or is this not the best use of state funds? Maybe you work for Kimberly-Clark or live in the community this affects. How is this affecting you? What do you want state leaders to know about what you need? Let us know, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Laurel White, good to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, John.
Well, let's turn first to Governor Scott Walker, who spoke to reporters for the first time last Thursday about his failed reelection bid. Laurel, how did he address the loss?
So the first thing that he said when reporters asked him how he was sort of thinking about the loss and what he was pointing to is that he was going to leave it to the pundits to talk more about that sort of analysis aspect of why he lost the election. But when kind of pressed, he did bring up one point that I think it's fair to say a lot of people have been talking about in the days after the election, which is turnout.
What do we know about voter turnout in this state?
So we know that it was a historically high turnout election. According to unofficial results from the State Election Commission, it was 59% of eligible voters, which is the highest Wisconsin has seen in a midterm election in history.
And it could be because Governor Walker himself commented that he got more votes in the loss than he had the other times when he won election.
Exactly. He said, you know, if I had gotten the same number of votes this year as I had in the past, they would have been enough to win in either previous election, because, as you said, he got fewer votes and won in 2014 and 2010. So it was just a really large electorate this year. And he said it was a unique race. And that was kind of the thing that he was comfortable, I think, talking about on Thursday.
What are Governor Walker's thoughts on any legislation during this lame duck period?
That was an interesting conversation we had with him as well, because I think, you know, there were a few things on reporters' minds when Governor Walker came back out after the election. He had sort of gone radio silent for a bit, and he said that that was in respect of Governor-elect Evers. He wanted him to have a little bit of time. And so when the governor came back, we wanted to ask him, of course, his thoughts on the election, but we wanted to talk to him about all of these legislative proposals that are floating out there for the lame duck session that could happen sometime in the next couple months before the inauguration, and what he thinks about all these proposals. So there's Kimberly-Clark, obviously, which we'll talk about. Then there are these sort of very amorphous ideas. We don't have a lot of details on them, about limits to executive power in the governor's office, to do with administrative rules and state boards. And Walker weighed on those weighed in on those individually, and we can break them down more if you want. But overall, he seemed pretty amenable to the things that GOP lawmakers are talking about. He said they were pretty reasonable.
And also, the other thing that came up was possibly doing something with the calendar in terms of spring elections?
That's right. So this is an interesting one. This is new. It was new just on Thursday, actually, before we went in to talk with the governor. What they would be doing there is essentially splitting off the state Supreme Court race in 2020 from the presidential primary. And the reason that they would do that is the governor said, when we asked him about it, you know, I have always thought it was kind of strange to have a nonpartisan election, the state Supreme Court race, on the same ballot as a partisan election, like the presidential primary. He said, you know, I've always kind of thought that was funny, never really got it. And so this is an opportunity to extricate those two things, make them two separate elections. Now, Democrats are pushing back on that and saying the only reason Republicans would want to do something like that is a conservative-backed justice, Daniel Kelly, is up for re-election in 2020. And as we know, presidential elections, primaries, and generals tend to draw out more Democrats. And so they're saying that having more Democrats coming out to vote would hurt Justice Kelly and compromise his reelection chances. So Democrats are pointing to this as sort of a very politically motivated partisan thing that Republicans are trying to do before Walker leaves office.
And did anyone ask about how to justify the additional cost and additional work for local election officials by having two separate elections instead of one? I mean, that was that seemed to be an issue this past spring.
It was. That was something that the governor talked about when there was the push for special elections this spring. And so they said, well, if you were concerned about the cost of extra elections so recently, why isn't that a factor for you now? Having a separate election for the state Supreme Court race is a separate event in which, you know, clerks have to plan materials, staffing, et cetera. It is expensive. How do you respond to that sort of change in your view? And the governor just revisited that argument that he made previously, which is, you know, I always thought it was kind of funny that it was a nonpartisan race on a partisan, you know, for during a partisan election. So he was asked about it, but he didn't really respond to that point in particular.
All right, let's go back to Kimberly Clark. GOP lawmakers have talked about taking up new proposals like, changes to gubernatorial power, and we'll get to those. But the Kimberly Clark incentives package, let's start with that. Some have called it Foxconn-esque. Maybe that's a word that'll make it in the Oxford top 10 next year. Remind us, what's the aim of the Kimberly Clark package?
So the Kimberly Clark incentive package is aiming to keep a Kimberly Clark plant in the Fox Valley open. It's a facility that employs about 400 people just outside of Neenah in Fox Crossing. And the company announced in January that it was considering closing two Wisconsin facilities as part of a global reorganization. Governor Walker came out pretty quickly after that and said, hey, if we offered you the Foxconn incentives, these Foxconn-style, Foxconn-esque incentives, would you keep these facilities open? It's been determined by Kimberly Clark that they are going to close the smaller of the two, but the larger of the two, this one in Neenah, Fox Crossing, is still on the table pending you know, what the state decides to do with this incentive package.
And how many jobs are we talking about there?
So it's 388 total. But Kimberly Clark did say that they were considering adding an additional 52, I believe. Mm-hmm. So a little bit north of 400 jobs.
And the case that supporters are making has to do with keeping people working and contributing to the economy and so forth?
Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit more than just kind of the base level, this one Kimberly Clark plant. People are talking about Kimberly Clark's statewide effect on the economy. So it's supply chain. They say that they have about 200, a little bit more than 200 businesses in Wisconsin that supply things to Kimberly Clark. So they're really kind of one of those base anchor businesses for the state of Wisconsin. That's what supporters say.
And quickly, what would Kimberly Clark have to do to qualify for the package?
They would have to create a certain number of jobs and keep a certain number of jobs over the next 15 years.
Laura White is a state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She stays with us as the state capitol report continues. What are you watching when it comes to legislation involving incentives for Kimberly Clark or measures to limit the power of the incoming governor? Are you in favor of either or both of these? Do you have some things that you would like to see the legislature take up right away that maybe haven't been mentioned yet? What do you think about moving the date of the spring election in 2020 to separate the state Supreme Court election from the presidential primary? What do you think of that idea? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or mention WPR Mornings on Twitter. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Laura White, WPR's state capitol reporter, is with us to talk about what's happening in the aftermath of the midterms. Laura, we were talking about Kimberly Clark. Just a couple more questions about that before we move on. A proposal to provide incentives to Kimberly Clark passed the Assembly in February, but has so far not been able to get enough votes to pass in the Senate. How many votes would be needed in this lame duck session, and do they have them?
Mm-hmm. So they need 17 votes to pass the package, and they do not have them as of right now, or at least the last time we checked in with Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald. So what we do know about kind of the back and forth of votes on the package in the Senate is that there have been three Republican state senators who have come out publicly saying that they won't support the package as it's currently written. Now, that's really tricky because, say, the state Senate decides to make some changes to get these Republican votes. Well, then, of course, the Assembly would have to pass it again. That's something that we haven't checked in recently with Assembly Leader Robin Voss. But previously, he had said what passed the Assembly. They're not going to come back in and take it up. So there's kind of this delicate dance happening right now to see if they can get those Republican senators on board, or if they can't, potentially reaching out to Senate Democrats and seeing if they can get some Democratic votes on this package.
Well, how likely do you think it is that any Democrats in the state Senate would in fact support this to bail the Republicans out?
Well, you know, I've talked to a couple Senate Democrats, and generally the line from them has been, we haven't heard from Republicans. We do have ideas, but they haven't been reaching out to us to get us on the same page with this package. So I think probably what Democrats would need to vote for it would be, again, some changes. And then that runs up to some difficulties in the Assembly. So there are a lot of moving pieces here. It's going to be interesting to see what leaders end up doing.
Well, we had a caller who couldn't stay on who was concerned that Republicans would try to insert other stuff in any Kimberly Clark incentive package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's part of the discussion, what changes could be made at this point. Another thing that has been brought up is the fact that Governor Walker could veto the bill to make some substantial changes after it passes. That's something that he had done, you might recall, in the last state budget negotiations. They had trouble getting enough support, again, in the state Senate. So he agreed to make some very specific vetoes to the budget to get senators to come on board and vote for it. So there's talk that he could do that with Kimberly Clark, but he told reporters on Thursday that he wasn't going to make any substantive changes to the bill. It would just be sort of technical things and cleanup things if he was going to make any vetoes.
Let's take a call from Maddie in De Pere. Maddie, good morning.
Hi. It really irritates me that the mostly the Republicans, that they shell out so much money for a foreign company, but for Kimberly Clark, they're you know, dragging their feet. And I think it's because it's a good-paying, good-benefit union shop, and the Republicans absolutely hate unions. And I'm really irritated, too.
All right, Mandy, thanks. Any thoughts there that the Republicans don't like the Kimberly Clark deal because Kimberly Clark is a union shop?
That isn't an argument that I've heard specifically until now. I have definitely heard the argument that, you know, Kimberly Clark is a Wisconsin company, and that's a reason that state lawmakers should consider supporting it above and beyond what they did for Foxconn, which is, of course, a foreign corporation.
You know, this kind of begs the question, if Foxconn hadn't happened, would it have been so difficult? Would this argument or debate over the Kimberly Clark incentives package be so difficult?
I think it's definitely a factor, and that's something that we can't know, but there's definitely a discussion about setting a precedent. And if you have the Foxconn incentive package and then you have the Kimberly Clark incentive package, which is modeled on it, what sort of precedent does that set for other Wisconsin companies or other foreign companies that are looking to move somewhere? Does it sort of set the state of Wisconsin up for a situation in which people believe they can get this amount if they ask for it? Mm-hmm. So that's some concern that some lawmakers have voiced.
What kinds of accountability would Kimberly Clark have under the incentives package? Do you know?
So it's very similar to the Foxconn package. So they have to keep a certain percentage of jobs. They would have to keep, I believe it's 93% of the jobs that they said they would at the plant. So that's 93% of the 388. They also have to keep 93% of their statewide jobs. They have a number of facilities around Wisconsin. And if they don't meet these benchmarks that are, I believe, are assessed annually, the state gets to claw back the money that it has given Kimberly Clark for keeping those jobs.
And has Governor-elect Evers weighed in on the incentives package?
Governor-elect Evers has said that he hasn't read the bill, and so he can't weigh in on it specifically. And that's something that's gotten a little bit of pushback because the bill's been out there for a while.
Yeah, well, it could be that. I think in politics, that's called a punt. another issue the legislature may act on, and this would directly affect Governor-elect Evers, is the possibility of limiting his power when he takes office. What's the latest here?
So there are a couple of proposals there. There are sort of two sections of that limitation of state power, of executive power, excuse me, conversation. One is to do with administrative rules, and specifically Wisconsin's voter ID law. So right now, Wisconsin's voter ID law is, of course, a law, but there are a number of things called administrative rules that go around that law to help in its implementation. And administrative rules are something that the governor has quite a lot of power over. That's something that lawmakers actually in 2011 created for Governor Scott Walker. So if Governor-elect Evers comes into office, he could potentially use that power to rewrite the rules surrounding voter ID and make it less robust. That's what Republican supporters of the law are saying. So the change would be to take away some of that power to work on and manipulate administrative rules a bit. And that's something that Governor Walker has said seems reasonable. Republicans who are in support of it say, you know, this is about balancing the power between the legislative branch and the executive branch.
And, we can have a discussion about that all day, but let's move on. Beyond this, any other proposals on the table that lawmakers might discuss in this lame duck session?
Mm-hmm. So they're also talking about changing the makeup of some state boards, which sounds a little bit wonky, but there's one example in particular I think people will find a bit more intriguing than others, possibly, and that's the makeup of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation Board. And that's something that's really been at the center of political discussions throughout this election. Governor-elect Evers says he wants to do away with WEDIC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, entirely. So if Republican lawmakers took away some of the gubernatorial appointments to that board or added more legislative appointments to sort of water down Evers' influence, that would be something that they believe could help protect WEDIC and make sure that governor-elect's thoughts about the agency don't sort of seep into the administration there.
Of course, he could in turn just veto the entire WEDIC budget, I guess, if he wanted, and that would set up another confrontation and more stories for you to cover.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the Evers transition. Joint Finance approved roughly $95,000 to help as Tony Evers prepares to take over the office of governor in January. What does that budget allow for?
So that allows for Governor-elect Evers to hire some staff. I think he outlined 7 full-time positions for his transition. Those staff are helping him do things like hire additional people, look at some different policy proposals that he'll implement once he comes into office. You know, the governor has to propose the state budget pretty quickly after he's inaugurated. Usually that address is in February, and he's inaugurated on January 7th. So there's quite a bit of work to do for Governor-elect Evers over the next several weeks. It's sort of like hiring an entire company over the course of, 6 or 7 weeks, because he has to have the entire governor's office, and then he has to figure out who he wants to appoint to those high-level cabinet positions as well.
Well, and he has a chief of staff. Do we have any idea who some of the other administration members will be?
We don't yet. We don't have any specific announcements. We do know that, his chief of staff, as you mentioned, was his campaign manager, Maggie Gao. But as far as specific heads of departments and things like that, we haven't gotten those. It's kind of funny. We were following up with the Evers transition team pretty quickly, like, oh, what's going on? Do you have any more announcements for us? And his future chief of staff said, you know, it's only been a week since the election. So time moves quickly now, and they do have a lot to do over the next several weeks.
They do. They have a lot to do and not a lot of time to do it. So the coming week, it's Thanksgiving. A lot of people are out, I don't know, deer hunting or doing other things. So I'm not expecting a ton of legislative action this week. But what are you watching this week?
We're keeping an eye on those negotiations over the Kimberly-Clark bill. We'll be checking in with Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald to see if he's been able to get any of those Republican senators on board with the package, because that's something that they talked about doing in November. So we're definitely going to be keeping a close eye on that and any other ideas that surface for possible bills in the lame duck session.
Okay. Well, and that'll give us another reason to talk to you again next month.
Sounds good.
Always a pleasure, Laurel. And I do hope we speak again next Monday and find out what happened this past week in the state capitol. Appreciate your time as always.
Thanks, John.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Coming up next, the nation has an oversupply of Wisconsin's official state fruit, the cranberry, which could result in 25% of this year's crop getting dumped. We discuss what that means to our state, the nation's leading producer of the fruit, and what can be done with the excess. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The nation has an oversupply of Wisconsin's official state fruit, the cranberry, which could result in 25% of this year's crop being dumped. We're going to talk about what this means to our state, the nation's leading producer of cranberries, and what might be done with the excess. Are you a cranberry producer? Do you have an oversupply? If so, how have you been managing it? What do you think can or should be done to protect the industry and deal with the cranberry glut? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program with your comment or question. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rick Barrett reports on manufacturing, telecom, and agriculture for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Rick, welcome to the morning show.
Yes, hi. Good morning, John.
The cranberry harvest happens every fall. When we say oversupply, what amount of cranberries are we talking about?
Well, they've had a good harvest this year, and national is where the oversupply is. I mean, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, New Jersey are the nation's top cranberry producers. And if you look at this from a national perspective, there's just way too much crop out there. And they've had, you know, very good crops for the past few years, which has built up this surplus, and it's literally millions and millions of pounds that are in storage and oversupply.
So how did we get to this point where we're producing more cranberries than there is a demand for them?
It's a good question. I mean, we're very good at producing cranberries now. I mean, there are new varieties that are incredibly productive. There are very large cranberry marshes and bogs out there that are incredibly effective at producing the berries. And also there's more production coming from other countries. And as those countries have come online, it's added to the global surplus of cranberries.
So the cranberry is popular outside of the United States?
Somewhat. It is extremely popular in the U.S. and in Europe. The market for cranberries is growing in other places, but it still has a ways to go.
What are the options for finding some use for the cranberry surplus? What can we do with these?
There are a few things that can be done. I mean, the handlers, as they're called in the industry, and you think of them as like Ocean Spray and other large processing companies, they can donate surplus to charities, and they can also keep some of it in storage, and they can divert it in various ways by selling some surplus in countries where they have agreements that are allowed to do this. And then also, it just comes down to some of the surplus will be destroyed. It'll be used as compost, spread as fertilizer, and essentially wasted to divert it from the marketplace.
And is the U.S. Department of Agriculture weighing in on this? What are they doing to try to help?
Yeah, it's a good question. The USDA authorizes this type of practice through what's called volume regulation. And under that, they say to the industry, look, you can withhold a portion of berries from the marketplace to try to get the supply back in balance with the demand. And so this goes way back, and it's not just cranberries. It applies to some other crops, too, where they tell the industry that you can keep a certain percentage off the marketplace, you know, for a given amount of time in order to get things back in balance.
That move would be illegal in other industries, but it's okay for agriculture?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, if you look at it, this goes back to the Capper-Volstead Act, which was adopted by Congress in 1922. And essentially, it allows agriculture producers through these associations, it gives them a workaround in terms mm-hmm. of antitrust laws.
Okay. Rick Barrett reports on manufacturing, telecom, and agriculture for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's here with us this morning to talk about cranberries. How appropriate. We're coming up to Thanksgiving, which is kind of the big cranberry season. Any of this surplus, does any of this have anything to do with tariffs? And have our producers been suffering from tariffs?
Yeah, that's a very good question also. Tariffs do play a role in this. I mean, the cranberry industry has been trying very hard to cultivate markets in Asia, for example. And this year, China slapped a 40% tariff on American cranberries. That's up from 25%. It was already pretty high. And, you know, cranberries have also been caught up in the trade wars with additional tariffs from Canada and from Mexico and the European Union. So it has made a difference because as the U.S. is trying to cultivate these overseas markets for cranberries, the timing is bad because now we've got the surplus and now we have tariffs. It's a bad combination.
Okay, so what about, well, Wisconsin is a huge producer of cranberries. You mentioned that Massachusetts and New Jersey also are cranberry producing areas. How has competition from other large producers impacted our Wisconsin farmers?
Yeah, you know, Wisconsin does very well in the industry. I mean, we're right at the very top. And, you know, again, there's a lot of cranberries that are produced on the East Coast. And there's also a lot of cranberries that are coming from Canada now, too. So they've really ramped up their production with some very new, large, highly efficient operations. And so this is an international issue. I mean, there are cranberries out there that are coming from other places, including Chile, for example. I mean, they're now into the cranberry productions, and there's just an oversupply on a global level.
Hmm. What are Wisconsin's producers telling you about having to dump this oversupply? How do they feel about it?
That's a good question. I mean, there's no one that likes the idea, and the smaller producers get a break on this, and if they're organic cranberry producers, they also get a break on this, so they don't have to, you know, go along with the USDA volume regulation program. But there's no one who likes the idea of having to waste a crop. I mean, they still have to pay to plant it, to grow it, all the cost of production, and so it's not something that they look forward to. Let's put it that way.
Well, what do the growers think we could do to improve the market? Do we need to find other uses for cranberries? What are they suggesting that ought to be done?
They're trying. I mean, there's all kinds of products out there. There's the craisins and the raspberry lemonade type, you know, products. There's all sorts of things that they're trying to come up with to, you know, increase the use of cranberries. And they're also working hard to develop the foreign markets But again, the bottom line is we're just too darn good at growing these things.
And now, well, we've got the these new cranberry varieties. You mentioned this, grow 2 to 3 times more berries. So maybe one of the things that needs to happen is we need to shrink the amount of production to match the demand. That would be pretty hard on the growers who had to shrink, though.
It is a tough thing because, you know, it's interesting with cranberries, and it's true in some other areas of agricultural, too, that it can take years, you know, to get your production where you want it to be, and to have to curtail it at that point, to have to, you know, limit your investment. It's a very difficult thing for them to do.
Is one of the factors here for Wisconsin growers the fact that the technology in Wisconsin for growing, or the process for growing cranberries, is maybe a little old, based on a little older technology than in some of the emerging growing areas?
Yeah, I mean, we're very good at growing cranberries here, but the marshes or bogs, as they're called here, a lot of them are very old, and it costs a huge amount of money to upgrade in terms of the size and the varieties and things like that, and it takes a lot of time. And there are other countries, like Canada is a very good example, where they've come online with some very new operations, and they're incredibly productive varieties. It's hard to catch up with that.
Well, is this a problem that Wisconsin has had in the past? I mean, certainly during the time when we were developing a commercial cranberry industry, there was quite a bit of investment in infrastructure.
Yeah, well, we've experienced this in the past. I mean, the USDA has stepped in before with its volume regulation program, and we've gone through this to some extent, not terribly often. I mean, there are some years when we've had an oversupply or an undersupply of cranberries. So it ebbs and flows.
What about the farm bill, which has yet to pass? Would a new farm bill possibly do something to help cranberry growers in Wisconsin?
I haven't seen this addressed in the farm bill yet, but that's still a work in progress. So possibly, I mean, there are a lot of things that are on the table in the farm bill.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, the surplus in cranberries. We've had milk surpluses and surpluses in other crops before, and we've managed to handle that. It seems like somebody ought to come up with something for the cranberry growers.
Yeah, it's a broad problem in agriculture now. You know, we've just become very good at producing a lot of commodities. And some years that's great. Other years it's a real problem.
So we're victims of our own success, I guess, the bottom line here. We did too well. We did too well.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Rick Barrett, thank you so much for joining us this morning to talk about the cranberry crop. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, John.
Rick Barrett reports on manufacturing, telecom, and agriculture for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I guess you could do your part for the cranberry surplus by having an extra helping of cranberry relish on Thursday, maybe. Coming up, we're going to talk about a subject that I actually was pretty interested to see this statistic. Deer hunting license sales in Wisconsin are declining. We're going to talk about why that might be happening. That's coming up. And you might be interested to note that the declining deer hunting license sales actually has something to do with what money we will have for conservation funding. We'll talk about that, and we'll get your thoughts on it as well as the morning show continues. This is the Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. Stay tuned. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Over the past 20 years or so, deer hunting license sales in Wisconsin have declined about 6%. If the decline continues, what will that mean for the future of conservation funding in Wisconsin? Well, that's one question. Hunters, what do you think needs to be done to increase the number of people who actually go hunting? Does the decline in licenses sold over the past few decades bother you? Why or why not? 800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program, 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Patrick Durkin is a freelance writer who covers recreation and the outdoors. He is a columnist for 17 Wisconsin newspapers, including USA Today's Wisconsin Network, the Wisconsin State Journal, and Wisconsin Outdoor News. Patrick, welcome back to the morning show.
Good morning, John.
A report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum says the number of deer hunting licenses sold in the state has dropped by about 6% in the last 20 years. What's that decline say to you?
Well, it says a lot of things to me because it's stuff that we've actually been aware of this problem going back into the late 1980s when we started, you know, if you look at the rural sociologist studies back then, Tom Heberlein, a friend of mine, was predicting in 1990 that this was going to happen, that, you know, basically people my age, the baby boomer generation, were not generating enough hunters to take our place one day. And now we're in that stage where the baby boomers are leaving the hunting population, and they didn't replace themselves in the same kind of numbers that they took part in hunting from. You know, so really, this isn't a shock to anyone who has been watching this news, you know, developing over the years.
So a 6% drop over two decades, is that significant mm-hmm. by itself, or is this kind of one of those things, sort of like the canary in the coal mine, and maybe there's a cliff out here we haven't seen yet?
Right. There's so many ramifications. It's always, you know, like when I wrote my column last week about this topic, and you look at it and think, well, where do you start? Because, you know, the fact we're losing hunters, and deer hunters especially, you know, makes it harder to manage the deer herd, and the deer herd starts climbing up and achieving big numbers. Well, how do you knock it back down to a manageable number? That's one factor. Then you also look at the funding, how much funding deer hunting provides for conservation in our state. And we've, you know, deer hunting has always been the bread and butter for the Wisconsin DNR. And as those numbers start dropping for license sales, there's really nothing, we've provided no safety net to fall back on as these numbers keep declining.
So let's talk about the relationship between the money coming in for licenses and funding for conservation and herd management. There's a direct relationship there. So if we don't sell licenses, we won't have the money to manage the deer herd?
That's part of it. And we also don't have the money to manage lots of things in wildlife. You know, a lot of the wildlife funding and even fisheries, over time has even relied on a lot of deer hunting numbers for the funding for this. So there's lots of neat funding mechanisms that the hunters have provided. And the one big one that we get from the federal government is, you know, every time a hunter buys a gun, ammunition, every time a recreational shooter buys a handgun or any kind of gun for, target practice, whatever it might be, bow and arrow, every time buy a hunting bow, a regular target bow, arrows, all those things pay an 11% excise tax to the IRS, which then gives the money to the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Fish and Wildlife Service puts it back into the states for their conservation efforts.
Hey, you mentioned the sociology of this. The baby boomers having fewer children than their parents did, and not only that, the population of rural Wisconsin is shrinking. These two factors don't make the future look very good when it comes to hunting, do they?
No. It is kind of discouraging, and you always keep wondering, at what point will it bottom out, and then we can get a real assessment of what we have to do in the future. And one of the studies that the University of Wisconsin did with the DNR about eight, nine years ago, they're predicting that basically our deer hunting license sales would bottom out sometime in the 1930s. I think they were predicting somewhere in the 425,000 range for deer hunting, which is about another 150,000 to go for us at the rate we're at right now.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call. Brandon is with us in Toma. Brandon, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I think one of the bigger issues you kind of hit it with the shrinking population, but the dynamic shift in ages, I just don't see as many younger hunters getting into hunting anymore. And on top of that, I remember growing up and you couldn't find a spot on any county land to hunt at all without seeing another hunter. And now, over the years, like I remember the Earn a Buck program really killed Clark County, and I feel the DNR always overestimating the deer population in general. I remember growing up, you could basically shoot as many deer as you wanted, and that was always a great incentive. That's pretty much all I got.
Okay, Brandon, thanks for that. Pat Durkin?
Well, you know, there are lots of factors that weave into it, but the biggest thing is, you know, we have shifted as a society. You know, we have, you know, if we could have maintained the participation rates we enjoyed back in the 70s and 80s as a percentage of the population, hunting would be booming right now. But, you know, but we have not done that. And, yeah, you can pick out individual things that turn people off year to year and whatever it might be, you know, in their area. But I guess the one thing I keep talking about is in Wisconsin, we are fortunate to have lots of public land to hunt on. You know, Wisconsin is not hurting for places for people to go hunting. The problem comes into it for a lot of people is it's not as convenient as they would like. You know, we don't have huge public hunting grounds near our biggest population centers. So that's a problem not unique to Wisconsin.
Yeah, there's been a lot more development in the as the suburbs have spread out from the major metropolitan areas. What about our caller's point, though, about the Earn a Buck program? Is that a common complaint among hunters?
Well, it was definitely a disliked program for a lot of hunters, but for a lot of us, a lot of other hunters, though. Personally, I liked it. Every time I looked at the success of that program, it was very effective at bringing down the deer numbers where they had to be brought down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can nitpick about how well the DNR estimates deer populations, but I'd always argue that, you know, it's a consistent program they developed for over the decades, and you can't count deer like you'd count people. And I think, too, is all you got to do is think about how much we fight every 10 years about the U.S. Census. And you think we can't agree on how best to count people. So counting deer becomes even more problematic.
Well, and the deer population isn't spread evenly over the state, just like the human population isn't.
Oh,
in northern Wisconsin, I don't think anybody's complaining about a surplus of deer up in Sawyer County, for example.
Right. Yeah, and like right now I'm sitting in the Heverland Shack in Ashland County, and we killed our first deer here for the first time in 5 years. And meanwhile, when I was down in Richland County on Saturday and Sunday, I counted, you know, some of these deer are probably the same deer I saw, you know, before and, you know, in the morning and beginning in the afternoon. But I saw 30 deer in one day sitting down in Richland County. And so it really shows the variance where you have this mature forest up here in Ashland County does not hold that many deer. And you get down farm country with pretty good woodlots, lots of agriculture, lots of food for deer. So, of course, they're booming down there again.
Has the DNR looked at other methods of funding conservation programming?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those ongoing efforts, and it's always a matter of getting people to buy into it and getting lawmakers to pass it. You know, Missouri and Minnesota, for example, they impose like either a penny or a half penny, something like that, for sales tax. So they divert that half penny or quarter penny into a general conservation fund. So that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have, you know, things like, different licenses, so many different licenses we have now, and trying to find ways within those individual licenses to get value. But, you know, Wisconsin hasn't increased their license fees in, you know, 13 years now.
Okay. All right. Well, Patrick, we know you'll be watching this, and I'm sure we'll be in touch as this story develops. Patrick Durkin, freelance writer who covers recreation and the outdoors, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, John.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.